Thanks, Hamilton. It's good to be here. Always good to be in Adelaide. And I like, this is my first morning tea, I think, that I've done since I've been at Cedar. And I like the concept of a morning tea. It feels like it disappears in your midlife, the morning tea. And aside from my six-year-old daughter on Saturdays at about 9 a.m. saying, "When's morning tea, Dad?" I don't feel like I get along to too many morning teas these days, so it's really nice to be here for that. And I was saying to someone before, it's always good to come to these events and hear from you about what you're seeing in the economy and the labour market. I almost feel guilty because I generally learn more than I think some of my audiences might when I come to these things. So when we come to the Q&A, I'm always really interested to hear South Australian perspectives. Having said that, where I can, I'll try and kind of point out particular South Australian data points as I go through the presentation and some of the implications. But there will be things that I'm sure are on your mind, which we can discuss in the Q&A. I'd also like to thank Fragerman and Chris Spensaris, who's here today, for sponsoring the series of events across Australia, and also my co-authors on the report, Gabriella D'Souza, who's our senior economist, and also Henry Sherrell, an immigration expert out of Canberra. So always important to acknowledge that others are involved in these projects. So I think you'd have to say that population and immigration are never far from the headlines, and certainly in the lead up to the federal election this year, that was no exception and only intensified. We think it's a debate that's fundamentally important to Australia's future economic development. The growth, the makeup, and the settlement of Australia's population will be incredibly important to our living standards in the future. And we've, for that reason, put population front and centre on our research agenda. We released a paper last year called Connecting People with Progress that identified five areas for our future research agenda, and population was one of those five areas. So when we look over the past... Oh, gone backwards, eh? When we look over the last 70 years, more than 7 million permanent migrants have called Australia home, with more than 2 million in just the last decade. And that means that today 28% of Australians were born overseas, and half of us have a parent who was born elsewhere. And the really great thing about Australia is that we've done this with an incredible level of community consensus. The Scanlon Foundation finds that 80% of people agree that immigration has been good for the Australian economy. Nonetheless, it has become an increasingly contested topic in recent years. And in Sydney and Melbourne, where I'm from, those concerns tend to centre around the scale of immigration, the concentrating settlement in cities, and the impact on existing infrastructure, services, jobs, and educational opportunities. Here in South Australia, I think the concerns are more about sluggish population growth and attracting young, skilled people. But if we're to get immigration policy right, I think it's fair to say that we need a public debate that is considered, circumspect, forward-looking, and based on fact. But this can only be achieved if we have a better understanding of the finer points of the policy, the nature of migrant flows, and the impact. The public debate in that regard so often focuses on permanent migration, or it fails to draw a distinction between temporary and permanent migration. So for that reason, we really wanted to shine a light in this report on temporary migration. And we particularly wanted to shine a light on the issue of temporary skilled migration. This area has so often been a lightning rod for concerns about Australian jobs and wages. But with an ageing population, and here in South Australia, the second oldest population in Australia, the need to import talent and expertise to build up our skill base in new industries and plug short-term gaps is only going to persist and grow stronger. The report talks about how this distinction between temporary and permanent has often been poorly understood. But despite this, temporary migration has been growing in importance in actual fact since World War II, and it's really accelerated in the last two decades, but in some respects it's really not that new. So we're now at a stage where we have almost 2 million temporary migrants in Australia. And when we look at who those people are, well, many people are surprised to learn that around a third of these are New Zealand citizens who are here on special category visas with work and study rights. Now, on the other hand, with education being our third largest export now, I think fewer people are surprised to hear that international students make up a quarter of that group. And here in South Australia, I think the latest count is around 36,000 international student enrolments. So it's key in this economy as well. There's also 230,000 bridging visas. So these are people who've applied for other visas, but their original visa has expired in the meantime. We've also had strong growth in working holiday makers. That's reached almost 135,000. And I think a particular force behind that has been the strong performance of our labour market post the global financial crisis compared to other economies, and also the low Aussie dollar in that period. And finally, there's almost 150,000 temporary skilled migrants. And this is an area that I'll obviously speak about in greater depth as we go through. Around 4,000 of those at last count are here in South Australia. So temporary migration has been remarkably responsive when you look at it to the economy. And just to take one example, during the once in a generation mining boom that we had at the height of that 68,000 primary temporary skilled visas granted in 1 year. Last year, it was just half that. So you can see in the numbers that this is a program that responds very much to the economic conditions in Australia. The other one, of course, has been universities, and with continuing economic strength and the changes that allowed universities to charge international students full fees, we've seen a fourfold increase in international students in the last two decades. So these are all interesting numbers, but how do they actually impact our total population? Well, the answer to that question is different over the short term and the long term. In the short term, temporary migration is the biggest contributor to the level of net overseas migration that we have, and also the population. So in 2016-17, temporary migrants accounted for 70% of net migration and 45% of total population growth. Now, but you can see in this chart for 2017-18, these trends are very different across states, with temporary migration making a comparable contribution to permanent here in South Australia, whereas you can see in New South Wales and Victoria, for example, that that is not the case. In actual fact, South Australia accounted for 7.4% of total permanent migration last year, which compares to its population share of about 6.9%. In the longer term, when we look at the longer term drivers of population growth, the biggest lever is the permanent visa program. And of course, this number is subject to an annual cap under the federal government. So when we look at what's happened over the last... we're not sure what's happened there, but I assure you that I didn't do this chart with value M for the different categories, so you'll have to excuse me on that. So in the last decade, the population grew by 3.7 million, and that is the combined, the red and the yellow that you see up there. Just for some context, during that period, South Australia's population grew by 150,000 over that 10 years. Net migration contributed 2.25 million, so that is the orange block on that chart. And during that same period, 1.9 million visas were granted, and that's the green spot there. So you can see from that that permanent migration was really the driving force of population growth over the long term. But of course, temporary migration acts as an important pathway to permanent migration. Since at least 2012-13, at least half of the permanent skilled visas were granted to temporary skilled migrants who were already here on shore. In contrast, international students are much less likely to become permanent residents. Only 16% remain in Australia on a permanent visa after 20 years. So we think this de facto pathway from temporary skilled migration into permanent migration is a big positive for Australia. Temporary skilled migrants are young, productive, well-educated, and they've already proven themselves in the Australian workforce. The system still maintains the delineation between temporary and permanent streams, but there are avenues there for successful transition to permanent residency. But this doesn't mean that governments can simply set and forget and leave the temporary migration program to run its course. As the population of temporary migrants grows, there are important implications, particularly for the federal government. Workplace laws must be enforced and complied with to prevent exploitation of temporary migrant workers, a practice which really undermines Australia's reputation internationally. And the Migrant Worker Task Force, chaired by Alan Fells, has really shown the way on this and the recommendations that government needs to address it. It's also really imperative that we minimise administrative burden and uncertainty in the visa processing system as the number of applications grows. And the number of bridging visas is a good proxy for how well the system is performing in that regard. And at 230,000, it's at its highest level on record. It's also really important that Australia doesn't inadvertently create a class of permanent temporary visa holders and a class of people who permanent migration is always just out of reach along with the associated safety nets. Excluding temporary migrants from New Zealand, there were 46,000 people who were on temporary visas at the end of 2008 who were still on them in 2016. So that gives you an idea of the number of people who are in that sort of cohort. And finally, of course, governments need to factor in temporary migrant flows and data into their planning for budgets, infrastructure, and service delivery. So now I want to move to this question of jobs and the impact on Australian jobs. So this anxiety stemming from migration about the impact on local jobs has been a consistent theme for some time here in Australia. Waxing and waning with changing labour market conditions and the kind of apparent availability of jobs in the labour market. So in CEDA's report, our senior economist, Gabby D'Souza, puts these claims and assertions to the test by rigorously assessing whether the success of recent waves of migrants have come at the expense of local workers. The economic modelling using ABS data shows that recently arrived migrants have not had a negative impact on the wages or participation rates of local workers. In actual fact, the results suggest that at certain levels of experience and qualification, an increasing proportion of migrants is associated with a positive impact on wages and employment. These results build on previous modelling that was undertaken by for the Productivity Commission in 2016, which also found that the entry of migrants did not have a negative impact on the labour market outcomes of local workers. The results are highlighted in the report. There's also an appendix for those who are really interested in the detail of that methodology on our website. And I'd encourage you to have a look at it, if for no other reason than for Gabriella to have the satisfaction that people have looked at the detail on this. I think there were 24 downloads on the first day, so she was happy with that. So despite all of that, I don't think there's any doubt that the education and training system can do a much better job of preparing workers. And we've certainly been vocal about the challenges in the vocational education and training system, a system which has seen no real funding increase in the last decade. But regardless of how good our training and education system is, there will always be shortages. There will always be times when we can't keep up, when training and education is not fast enough, particularly in Australia's case for large, complex and lumpy projects in areas like resources and infrastructure. This is where temporary skilled migration under the newly coined subclass 482 visa has an important role to play. The temporary skilled migration system seeks to target short-term and medium and long-term strategic skills shortages, while doing so in a way that doesn't present a barrier to appropriately qualified Australians receiving these roles. And let me just say that Australia confronts plenty of workforce challenges. And to take just a couple of examples, we're going to need 18,000 cybersecurity workers by 2026. Currently, there are about 500 graduates a year in cybersecurity. We're also going to need to triple our aged care workforce within the next three decades to meet anticipated demand. But temporary skilled migration isn't just about plugging gaps. It's about building Australia's human capital through the transfer of knowledge, skills, and international connections. And you've seen this with advanced manufacturers like CSL and Cochlear, who've utilised skilled migration to build up their skills base and enable them to undertake advanced manufacturing here in Australia. So when we look at, we mapped the temporary skilled shortage visa process, it's up there on the screen. I'll do a quiz in a few minutes on it. If you could just start jotting it down, that would be great. But what you see there is it's a pretty rigorous process, you'd have to say. There's lists of eligible occupations, there's salary thresholds to ensure that wages aren't undercut, there's labour market testing by employers, English language requirements, the Skilling Australia Fund levy, which employers pay towards the skills and training initiatives for Australian workers. So occasionally I have seen in some literature people talking about this process as a backdoor to permanent residency. I think if that's the back door, I don't want to see the front door. So it's quite a process. And out of all of this comes a working sort of cohort of visa holders, including family and dependents, of working age, less than 1% of the labour force. And even during the mining boom, it was less than 1.4% of the labour force. So I think it's important to keep in mind, particularly when you see press around this part of the visa program, that they're the kind of numbers that we're talking about in the context of our whole labour force. So what do we know about Australia's temporary skilled migrants? Well, they come from countries like the United Kingdom, India, the Philippines. Here in South Australia, the other one is the United States. They are young, 96% are under the age of 50. They're developers, ICT business analysts, university lecturers and cooks. Additionally, in South Australia, general practitioners have been high on the list in recent years. They have an average base salary of $95,000. And in South Australia here, I think it's $97,000. Over 70% reside in New South Wales and Victoria, obviously states with the lowest unemployment rates at the present time. And just 2.6% reside here in South Australia, so far less than the population share. So addressing skills shortages and maintaining confidence around this issue of Australian workers being given first priority, I think, has not been easy amid changing labour market conditions and also changing community attitudes. As we document in the report, this has seen a system that's in a constant state of flux. It's been reviewed by multiple bodies with various terms of reference, often at too regular intervals to actually understand the impact of the last round of changes or the last review to the scheme. And the 2017 changes to the scheme were particularly stark, really taking all stakeholders by surprise by eliminating the subclass 457 visa altogether and replacing it with the 482 scheme. The changes resulted in a one-third reduction in eligible occupations, and a separation into two lifts with different conditions and restrictions. At the same time, we've seen increasing recognition that Australia isn't one homogenous labour market. And I think that's a very important point. Now, there's a lot more to be done on this, but at least people are recognising the fact that we have very different conditions across different parts of Australia. And so there are almost 4,000 people on labour agreements, whether these are at the company level, the project, industry, region-specific, and areas like the designated area migration agreements. So very, very much an intention to provide more tailored arrangements from the main system. We think there's a number of ways that you can embed greater stability in the system and lift stakeholder confidence. First, there's a need to be a lot more transparent, I think, about the data and the methods that are used in assessing whether occupations are included on the skilled occupation list. And the current information really is just a periodic release of a few pages of advice rather than detailed analysis. And this, I think, can be contrasted with the United Kingdom's Migration Advisory Committee, which just published an almost 400-page report outlining data analysis, occupation shortage rankings, and stakeholder feedback. We think more information will make decision makers more accountable and enhance the confidence of all stakeholders in the process for identifying skill shortages. I think this is also very, very important to my point around Australia isn't one labour market. It's not homogenous. And an important part of presenting more information is to get more information about the specific circumstances in particular parts of Australia and the skill shortages being experienced. Improving this process, we think, may also pave the way to revisit labour market testing and how it's conducted. This is a process that international policymakers suggest is unreliable, and employers find it overly prescriptive and very inflexible. Second, the skilled occupation list relies on the Australia-New Zealand Standard Classification of Occupations, otherwise known as ANSCO. It just rolls off the tongue, I have to say. It hasn't been reviewed in 6 years, which to us seems like an absolute eternity given the kind of technological and workforce changes that we're seeing in the economy at the present time. So we do think that the Australian Bureau of Statistics should be funded to undertake that review as a matter of priority. We also think that Australia should have a dedicated, streamlined path for intra-company transfers, which is something that the United States and United Kingdom have. When you look at large multinational firms, their most talented individuals are generally highly mobile. They move across jurisdictions to transfer knowledge, but also to develop their talents and future leadership. And this should be encouraged, both for Australians gaining experience abroad and also for talented international executives gaining experience here in Australia. This internal movement of resources, we think, is fundamentally different to having completely new entrants into the labour market. There also needs to be a clearer nexus between the skills shortages that give rise to the use of temporary skilled visas in the first place and the Skilling Australia Fund levy, which employers now pay. And this should underpin the allocation of funds to local training initiatives. There's also steps that the government can take to embed, I think, better evaluation and policy making in the future so that we get out of this constant state of flux that we seem to be in. Following the lead of the UK's Migration Advisory Committee that I just mentioned, I think we should have an independent committee of labour market specialists to undertake analysis, consultation and advice on the formulation of skilled occupation lists. Once again, this enables an organisation to really take a detailed look right across the country in terms of what's happening in particular regions on the ground, consulting with stakeholders. And finally, the Federal Treasurer should task the Productivity Commission with undertaking regular evaluation of the process. Now, we've suggested every 3 to 5 years. And again, to get us out of that set of sporadic reviews, often politically initiated and motivated, into a really systematic program of evaluation. So in conclusion, I think Australia has long been a proponent of open global markets when it comes to capital, when it comes to enterprise, services, and the success of our economy. And we've done that even as trade tensions and tariffs and so forth are rising globally. We've stayed the course on that. I don't think the same vigour always prevails for open markets when it comes to welcoming migrants and to bringing in global talent into our labour force. Yet the vibrancy of our economy and society has been shaped by migration over many years, and it will continue to be in the years ahead. Our future economic development will require the right people at the right time, whether that's to work, to study, to holiday, or to apply ideas and technology to create new high-value goods and services. If we're to do this in the best interests of migrants and the community, we'll need to build greater consensus and confidence in our temporary migration system. Thank you very much.